Rich. It's great to have you with us. Let's start back 1969. This is your first big national story, the My Lai massacre. Could you just remind us what the story was about and what, if any, contemporary significance you'd associate with it?
Well, it was the end of innocence about us in war. We'd all thought we'd gone through World War II. I was raised in Chicago during those years, and my sisters would take me to the war movies where our boys were always, you know, had, you know, thumbs up, scarves around the neck, flying P-51s, and the nips always had the hatch closed and were wearing funny little headgear, and squinted. And at a critical moment, Van Johnson would be chasing Robert Ryan, and they'd be fighting about a nurse the next one day, and the next day Robert Ryan would save Van Johnson's life, and just before the nip was going to kill Van Johnson, Robert Ryan would fire bullets, and we'd all cheer as the plane would go down, and we'd hear the "grrr" as the plane went to the water. And just before it hit the water, bullets had been flying into the cockpit. The nip of blood would come from the corner of his lip, and he'd hit the water. And that was it. That was the war for us. And it turned out that Americans don't fight wars any better than anybody else. We dehumanize the other people. That's just the reality of war. It's one of the aspects of war in which, surprisingly enough, we don't do any better. So it was we got our eyes opened up to what war was about. And for that, that's something to be proud of, I think, in a way.
Mr. Vice President, one of the themes that comes out of the My Lai massacre investigative reporting that Mr. Hirsch did was the cover-up on the part of the Army. It really takes courageous effort by one of the infantrymen in sending letters to congressmen and others. When you think of back over this period a pattern of deception, and there's maybe one of the most revealing set of documents on this from the Pentagon Papers, which were Defense Department documents up through 67. Daniel Ellsberg leaks them in 71. And here's just an example of one of many. This is McGeorge Bundy National Security Action Memo from April 6, 1965, announcing that President Johnson has approved the increase of U.S. troops in Vietnam and actually changed the mission to a much more active footing. And after explaining these changes, Bundy concludes, quote, "The President desires that publicity be avoided and actions should be taken in ways that minimize any appearance of sudden changes in policy and could be understood as being wholly consistent with existing policy." Is this kind of deception necessary to protect American interests?
Well, in many ways, the Pentagon Papers are the most revealing document about the potential for vast government deception. It's in writing, it's clear. It was never expected to be exposed publicly. It was for candid discussion for history a long time down the road, but it was the story which we've repeated later, getting into war where you didn't know what you were getting into. You didn't know the culture you were presenting, you were invading, and the war turned sour and people became desperate. And one of the first things that happens is deception. You have to tell stories, fibs, about what's going on to keep up public morale. You have to exaggerate the possibilities of success when your own troops know better. And usually a president's prestige is involved in these things. And there's one rule that I've learned after a long time of watching government is that it's always easier to get into a war than to get out of one. And I think we're finding that right now. And in the process, there's deception, there's presidential involvement, and there's the cover-up. And that's where they usually really get in trouble. Because sooner or later, when you're covering up, as also often happens, a Cy Hirsch shows up and starts digging around, and the first thing you know, they've got the truth. The government, the presidents usually think they've got plausible deniability, that it'll never be found out. If it's found out, no one will trace it to them. It's always implausible. deniability, and that's when the trouble begins.
Okay, Mr. Troublemaker. 1974, you break another big story. This one is on the CIA's family jewels. Could you remind us a bit of what the family jewels were and whether there are any contemporary examples of them today?
Well, the first part of the family jewels were simply a series in 1973 or 74. Bill Colby became actually James Schlesinger, who had not been in the CIA, was appointed to run the CIA. And one of the things he learned that there'd been a lot of stuff off the books that he didn't know much about. So he asked for an internal study. And it was completed when William Colby, who was later famously described, he was a very religious, he was a very devout Catholic, and Kissinger always accused him of thinking he had to go to confession all the time. Colby, instead of burying the documents, just kept them going, kept the investigation going. I learned about him a year and a half before I could find out enough to get it published. I learned about him in early 73, and I kept on asking him. By the end of 74, I learned that, indeed, at the request of Lyndon Johnson, the CIA, which was mandated by law and ingrained in every CIA operative, that you do not do operations in America. That's the FBI's purview. And you would destroy the trust in the agency, which does so many sensitive things abroad. And one can argue so many important things abroad, theoretically. You don't operate. And they've turned out they've been operating since 67 domestically against individuals. And wiretapping, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a category of crimes that included an attempted assassination of foreign leaders. It was one hell of a mess that they were hiding. And I wrote a story about it that began a series of investigation in which I want to say Fritz, but I'm going to say Mr. Vice President. We always called him that back in those days. Well, Mr. Vice President had a major role in investigating later on the Church Committee. So it's one of those stories that should have changed, should have, could have, would have changed the way the intelligence community operated, but I'm here to tell you that it really did not in the long run. It did some good things, but things happen.
And do they continue to happen to this day?
Yeah. After 9/11, I haven't written about this yet, but the Central Intelligence Agency was very deeply involved in domestic activities against people they thought to be enemies of the state without any legal authority for it. They haven't been called on it yet. That does happen. Right now, today, there was a story in the New York Times that, if you read carefully, mentioned something known as the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC it's called, is a special wing of our special operations community that is set up independently. They do not report to anybody except in the Clinton, in the Bush-Cheney days, they reported directly to the Cheney office. They do not report to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or to Mr. Gates, the Secretary of Defense. They report directly to him. They are not, they have absolutely no, Congress has no oversight of it. It's an executive assassination wing, essentially. And it's been going on and on and on. And just today in the Times, there was a story saying that its leader, a three-star admiral named McRaven, ordered to stop the certain activities because there were so many collateral deaths. It's been going under President Bush's authority. They've been going into countries, not talking to the ambassador or to the CIA station chief, and finding people on a list and executing them and leaving. That's been going on, well, in the name of all of us. It's complicated because the guys doing it are not murderers, and yet they are committing what we would normally call murder. It's a very complicated issue because they're young men who went into the special forces, the Delta Force that you've heard about, Navy SEAL teams, highly specialized, in many cases, the best and the brightest, really, no exaggeration, really fine guys that went in to do the kind of necessary jobs they think you need to protect America, and then they find themselves torturing people. And I've had people say to me, 5 years ago, I had one say, what do you call it when you interrogate somebody and you leave them bleeding and then you don't let them have any medical care and 2 days later he dies? Is that murder? What happens if I get before a committee? But they're not going to get before a committee, I don't think.
Speaking of committees, there is obviously some discussion in Congress about a Truth Commission or some other investigation. What's your view about that?
Well, in a perfect world, it'd be great. I can understand why President Obama wants to look forward, because he's got so many issues on the table. And I'm not sure what kind of cooperation they would get. They'd have to really get very, very tough with the executive. And I could just see a lot of reasons for a president not to want this kind of distraction. On the other hand, Senator Leahy, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and Congressman Conyers seem to be in agreement. They want it. And the nice thing about this new government, and the nice thing about our Constitution and democracy, is that, of course, this evil twosome, Cheney and Bush, left. Don't minimize daydreams and wishful thinking, but they left. They left. They're gone. And so now the Constitution worked, and so now perhaps Congress will be more forceful. And even though Obama may not want it, they may go ahead, because there's no longer the tyranny. It's as we've, Mr. Vice President would say, this has been one hell of a 8 years.
Mr. Mondale, let me go back to 1974. You've been in the Senate for 10 years, almost 10 years. And Seymour Hersh runs this blockbuster story in the New York Times. What kind of impact does that have on you?
Well, it was stunning, because I had been in the Senate. I had never heard about the family jewels or any of these disclosures that were printed in your story. It was on the front page of the New York Times, and I remember being on the Senate floor, and John Pastore got up, raised this story, and he said, "This is not America, what's going on. We need to investigate this and correct the law and prevent it from recurring." And then the church committee was established. I was a member of that committee, and I chaired the domestic task force, the part that looked in the domestic side that you mentioned earlier. And it was a life-changing experience to find out what happened. You know, the stories are endless, but for example, J. Edgar Hoover believed that Martin Luther King was a hate leader, black hate leader, and needed to be destroyed as a public leader. And they hounded Martin Luther King for a couple of years, followed him, planted stories on him, tried to get the King separated, tried to get the Nobel Committee not to accept King as a laureate, all sorts of stuff, and even one letter suggesting, I think, suicide. That's the way I read it. And there were all sorts of things like that. Mail openings, black bag jobs, and so on, directed at dangerous Americans like Arthur Burns and Hubert Humphrey. There was no end to it. And so we the one thing that we did that I think really helped is we took your story and we were able to get into the government files. And we were able to kill all the rumors and all the suggestions, you know, that we were interfering with our nation's security. And in fact, establish a system that I think strengthened America. Because it gave us a way of doing secret things that we had to do, but making it accountable to a court, federal court, that was the FISA court, which was secret. And I really believed, when we got through with that, those hearings, which were, as you know, very well covered, and we passed the law, the Security Act, and I think it passed the Senate by 96-1, because when the full record was there, there was nothing you could do to say that this wasn't a real problem. I really believe that once that was in place, that we wouldn't have a problem again in the memory of anyone alive at that time. But, of course, we did.
After the Family Jewels, you went on to write an award-winning, highly influential book called The Limits of Power, that's about this paranoid, destructive relationship between Nixon and Kissinger. And one of the core themes is about the negotiations with the North Vietnamese government. Could you talk a little bit about that, and particularly the so-called secret plan that Nixon had worked out both with the North and then with the South?
Are you talking about the Duck Cook plan, or are you talking about later? There were a number of secret plans. Kissinger, this was, of course, one of the plans called for the use of tactical nuclear weapons in the war, which was very, very secret, and that was astonishing. The whole notion of conducting serious diplomacy with the North Vietnamese in secret, the whole notion of conducting, opening the China in secrecy, the whole notion that secrecy was essential for the day-to-day operations of the government, as the Vice President was mentioning, it's sort of anathema, it seems to me, to what America's about. And almost, this is all pre-Watergate. And so you could almost understand that this kind of thinking that the President Nixon had and Kissinger abetted him. I don't know to this day why, my attitude towards Kissinger to this day is frankly that I know he's still considered with a great respect, but I still think basically when the rest of us can't sleep at night, we count sheep, and he has to count burned and maimed Cambodian babies in my book. I have no mercy for him because I think he helped perpetrate a policy of secrecy that was, as I said, not only that, it was counterproductive because there was always an agreement to be had on the table. That doesn't mean the other side was great. But, you know, getting back to what you said about you thought it was over, and we all did in 1970. There was the Ryan Act. There was very good legislation passed. And so one of the things that we don't know much about, I know you're going to, I'm getting ahead of you about Iran-Contra, but I just want to say this, that very early in the Reagan administration, very early, by middle of 1981, Bill Casey, and there was so much hostility among many conservatives and many former CIA, many people still in the CIA, to the notion that Congress really was going to be an active participant and not just some paperweight, you know, flyover, that he began, we now know that Bill Casey began in the middle of 1981 cutting a deal with the Saudis to finance American covert operations, so you didn't have to go to Congress. So it's just amazing how quickly such good, and there was nothing quite like, nothing has been like the Church Committee. Now, I don't know if it will get anything out of this New Truth Commission either. That was an amazing, and I commend, you know, it's in the dung heap of history, the Senate Intelligence Committee report. But it's a document, to me, that's as important as the Pentagon Papers. It really is outlines. And it also was more, it also was prescriptive. It also gave ways to treat the problem. It wasn't simply like legislators will. They'll describe the problem, and then they describe the way legislation to fix it. And here comes the next administration. And within a year of taking office, they're already finding ways to undercut the Congress. So we really have, I don't know what the framers would do with what happened to the economy. It's really amazing to me that we managed to get such bad leadership so consistently. Just a ball.
I think there's an important point about all these examples, and that is that we tend to think about those secret agents that are misbehaving, about those FBI agents that are out on their own. But in fact, most of these serious scandals that are disclosed involve the president or a person around the president. They're often acting under direct or indirect orders from the White House. Not always, but very often.
You bet. Absolutely. And the president always hides, tries to pretend he's not there. We have that classically in the Iran-Contra affair. And it's safe to say that we'll never fully know. I can say this as somebody who's been writing from inside the White House in some degree in the last 8 years. I know a lot about Cheney's operation, but I know almost nothing about the relationship between Cheney and Bush. And I don't think we're really going to come to understand it at all. But anyway, we're ahead of you.
Mr. Mondale, Seymour Hersh concludes this book, Limits of Power. And I want to ask you about how you think about the limits of power. And he's got this very striking concluding section in which he says, quote, "Neither Nixon nor Kissinger ever came to grips with the basic vulnerability of their policy. They were operating in a democracy, guided by a constitution, and among a citizenry who held their leaders to a reasonable standard of morality and integrity, close quote. Did our constitutional system work in holding Nixon accountable?
Yes, and you said that earlier, and I think that's the great hope, that despite how we've abused it, with time, the Constitution works. The public starts smelling something and worrying about it. And the courts are able then to begin with cases. And the Congress starts finally responding to these challenges and holding hearings. And the politicians start worrying about their responsibility and things start changing. And I hope as we go through these tough stories that we remember that this constitutional system has proven itself time and time again in a very positive way. The idea of sharing power, the idea of accountability of power, the idea of checks and balances, the idea of accountability to the courts and to the American people was a bold thing to do when we started, and it's been fully vindicated, I think, by our experience since, despite disappointments. Many a president has thought that he can work around that. It's just a sort of a barrier to a strong presidency. But if they always in the long run find out that the system is stronger than they are.
Okay, so this is a very positive interpretation of the Constitution, but I'm going to leap ahead a little bit. To the last 8 years. The last 8 years have been good years for you. You've had a lot to work with. You've produced, I think, some of the most remarkable investigative journalism. And again, it was Cy Hirsch who was reporting on a whole slew of stories about Abu Ghraib or about the Rumsfeld-Cheney circumvention of the CIA. The various plans with regard to Iran. And so I want to ask you, do you think the system has worked when you kind of look back over 8 years and what the Bush-Cheney presidency accomplished?
Well, there's no question corrupt presidents are very good for me personally. There's just no question about that. No. But I know where the vice president's coming from. Because, as it was remarked earlier, we did have an electoral process. We had to go, it almost was inevitable that Bush had to win in a way, because unless we went to the bottom, unless we got to the absolute bottom, the public, if he had lost that election to Kerry, it would have been very hard for Kerry to believe it or not, I think, to run the government, because there would have been so many people feeling that he had usurped what George Bush had done. So we had to, in a funny way, play it out. I mean, history will look at that election maybe differently because we had to get to the, as I say, to the bottom of the pit so that you could overwhelmingly elect a Democrat. And George Bush can't raise money, for example, for his library right now. He's having trouble raising money, which is great. But there's no question that if somebody had asked me those words you read, I wrote in 83 when I finished that book, if somebody had told me that we not only would have had an Iran-Contra, what we would have had after 9/11, we would have had a president using fear to generate what they did after 9/11, and I'm doing a book on some of this stuff, and I'll get into it in more detail. There was things I know, like what I mentioned earlier about the JSOC. They were hard to write. Some of the stuff I know was hard to write in real time because of people inside. You had to sort of figure out how much you could say and measure it and check with them. You didn't want to put them in jeopardy. But in any case, I think what they did was extraordinary in this way. Cheney is always, as you and your class and your syllabus has made clear, what your students are reading in the class that you guys are jointly teaching. You're going back to Hamilton. You're going back to the unitary presidency, and Cheney has been sort of the archetype, the driving force of that. How to describe what they did that's different? They came in hating Congress. They wanted to overcome congressional oversight. They just didn't outmaneuver it or outwit it. They set about and using the language I'm going to use, they set about in the inside about talking about how to sabotage oversight. And what is the model for sabotaging oversight? The model turned out to be the Bill Casey model. The Congress's hold on, in the Constitution over the executive is about money. Everything that's being spent on defenses must be approved by the Congress, even the most secret operations. There are secret committees in Congress that review it. And so the answer was, let's run operations off the books. Let's find money elsewhere, and the hell with Congress. And it was talked about as this is the way to finally put those creeps in place. The contempt for Congress in the Bush-Cheney White House was extraordinary, just extraordinary. And it came out of Iran-Contra, the same idea, that scandal that was in the 80s when, if you know, that, well, I think you're probably the best person to tell the audience exactly what it was. You've studied it more carefully than anybody else here, perhaps.
Iran-Contra was the episode in American history where Ronald Reagan actually negotiated with terrorists, with the Iranians who had their satellite group in Syria were holding some of our CIA personnel hostage and other hostages. And part of the negotiations was to trade arms with the Iranians. The money that was then funneled to Nicaragua to support the rebels trying to overthrow the Marxist elected government in Nicaragua, despite the fact that there was a law known as the Boland Amendments that had been passed by majorities in Congress, presented to the President Reagan, who had signed it. And so what Ronald Reagan was doing, or his White House, was violating both a policy agreement, you don't negotiate with terrorists, and you certainly don't negotiate with the Iranians, but secondly, was violating the Boland Amendments, which had prohibited, by law, the support of the Nicaraguan rebels. So you've got the Iran-Contra Committee in Congress, the majority of the Democrats coming out with a scathing report that this violated law and the Constitution. And Dick Cheney, and other Republicans, but Dick Cheney, I think, took the lead along with his lead staff, David Addington, in writing this minority report that you speak of. Is really quite a remarkable document. It's coherent. It just reflects a very different, as you said, a Hamiltonian perspective.
And the critical thing was that, of course, the critical thing about Iran-Contra was that, as you said, that they were explicitly barred from using money, and they went around. They were selling arms. The Israelis were involved in this. They were selling arms for a profit, taking the profit, and the thought was to invest it. So after Elliot Abrams, it was also one of the people who later was, I think he pleaded nulla contendi to a couple of offenses or was found guilty, I'm not sure. He didn't serve time. Misprison of felony, he didn't tell the truth to Congress. Elliot Abrams was also involved, who became a key player in the Bush-Cheney White House. So what makes Bush-Cheney so interesting is that at some point they had a meeting after 9/11 of the people who were in the White House who worked in Iran-Contra. That would be Abrams and Cheney. And there were others involved who were also in the White House involved in, and they had a meeting of lessons learned. What I'm telling you literally took place. They had a little meeting of a small group of people who worked for Reagan and for George Bush when he was vice president, his father, President George Herbert Walker Bush, I guess, isn't it? Anyway, and at the meeting, here were some of the conclusions: that the Iran-Contra thing, despite the disaster, proved you could do it. You could run operations without congressional money and get away with it. The problem, the reason they got exposed, and this is what was said in the White House, that there were too many people that knew too much. Too many people in the military knew what we were doing in 85, 86. Too many people in the CIA knew. And Oliver North, many might remember, the great witness he was, and was the wrong person to be running that. So what you do is you tell nobody. This is one of the things Cheney wrote in his minority dissent to the Iran-Contra Committee. Cheney said, my God, Reagan was telling too many people too much. Don't tell Congress anything. You don't tell the CIA much. You don't tell the military very much. And you, Mr. Vice President, you're the Ollie North for this. We're going to run operations off the books, and you're going to honcho them. And this is what they did. And this is what is still left to be reported, this kind of stuff, this kind of extraordinarily contemptuous attitude towards the Constitution, but in the belief, the Cheney belief. Cheney's really bright. Cheney's a bright person, and in the belief that they were carrying out the Hamiltonian notion of a unitary president. I mean, and a profound belief they were doing the right thing. No mens rea, in other words, no sense of guilt.
But let me just walk you through the arc that appears your career followed. You have My Lai,
right,
which breaks, and it's the end of the Age of Innocence. And you expose this horrible massacre. And there's some consequences that flow from it. You do the family jewels, and you've got leaders in the Senate, led by Mr. Mondale, who pick it up. They do just a remarkable investigation without historical precedent to this day. You pass.
Don't forget who else is in the Senate, though. We were talking about this earlier. But Phil Hart. It was an amazing crowd.
It was an amazing crowd. And you've got legislation that comes out of it. You've got the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or the FISA.
The two committees.
You've got other things coming out of it. You've got kind of skipping ahead here a little bit. You've got the Iran-Contra controversy, which I think many people now do view as a significant constitutional crisis. But there was a blowback to it, and there were some pretty significant hearings and exposure to it. And then you get the Bush-Cheney years. And really what strikes me in listening to you is how fragile and vulnerable the constitutional system is, despite the fact it's been around for over 200 years, despite the many strengths of the system, that you can have such a small number of people in a clandestine way running, in some cases, an off-the-book operation. Are you struck with the vulnerability of this system?
There was another element that happened here that was very depressing, and that was the collapse, I think, of the mainstream press. And it's hard for me to talk about it because it's so much like this, worked all those years. I obviously was lobbying very hard. I know a lot of people at the New York Times, a lot of people at the Washington Post, and there were wonderful reporters in both places. James Risen wrote the first story about the secret wiretapping and surveillance of people. Dana Priest, who wrote about in the Washington Post, and who wrote all those stories about the detentions. What happened in the major newspapers is they joined the team. And I know this as somebody who was talking to my peers, my fellow Walter Pincus of the Washington Post, the people, and in both places, the newspapers will never want to admit this, but the message was passed to their investigative reporters, we're not picking holes, we're not attacking right now. This is an 02 and 03. There were a lot of questions to be asked journalistically about Bush's statements about WMD, about the weapons of mass destruction. And I can tell you right now, throughout the government, there was not total acquiescence in the notion that the Iraqis were that far along, because we had done so much bombing in the first Gulf War in 1991. And also there had been a very extensive series of investigations by the United Nations inspection team, known as UNSCA, the inspection team. Some of you might remember the name Marine Major Scott Ritter, and a very aggressive bunch of people. Rolf Ekéus, the Swedish diplomat, was the ambassador. And the UN team went into Iraq beginning in right after the end of the war in 91 and spent the next 7 years there, 6 months a year there. And they ended up concluding that we had totally demolished any significant nuclear facilities. And they wrote a long report in 1997. It was on the internet, was small type, 400 pages, two Brits wrote it, one of them was an intelligence officer. And if you went around, as I did, and talked to those people, you came away by the end of 2002 saying, these guys are nuts about WMD, it's just not there. There's nobody who has any first-hand knowledge that believes he has a weapon system at all in place. And it turned out he did not. It turned out he may have been his own worst enemy. But we didn't do the job, and I say we collectively, because we, the press, Jefferson, who was the great First Amendment man, any cliche you want rolling over in his graves, we did not challenge the president. We joined the team. We became jingoistic. It was very hard not to be. It was very hard not to, after 9/11, not to be want payback. We wanted to bomb. Everybody wanted to bomb Afghanistan. And Mr. Mondale writes in his book that was published in the 70s about the notion, we talked about this, the notion of the public having responsibility too. We're not, this is, you know, you talk about secrecy, but so much of this stuff is there. And the classic example of why what he said was so prescient is in the fall of, if you all remember John Walker Lynn, the Taliban kid, the 18-year-old kid from Caliban, from California, who his parents split. He was unhappy. He didn't smoke the hookah, and dropped out of school. He learned Arabic and joined the Taliban. It's an act out. I mean, pretty strange way to act out. But anyway, he's picked up in Iraq. He knows English. There's an incredible scene where a guy, a Marine who later was killed, ex-Marine in the CIA. On camera, which is against every rule of the intelligence agency. We had a lot of people there that were Tyros, that were newly trained in the field. In front of a camera, he asked this fellow, this American kid, who's been speaking Arabic as a Taliban for 8 months to his peers. He asked him in English because he knows he's American, so he's asking him a question. And of course, John Walker Lynn won't answer him. To say he knew English would get him killed by his people. He would be a spy for them because, oh my God, he's been with us for eight months speaking Arabic. He ends up getting, there was a shooting, the soldier gets, the ex-soldier, the Marine gets killed. The public's very, very angry about this. It's on C-SPAN or CNN. He's thrown into a prison. He's an open prison at Bagram Air Base. Other soldiers can come and throw feces and urine on him. He has a bullet in him for 5 days. It's not really removed. All in front of all of us. I mean, the treatment of him violated how many different protocols of the Geneva Convention? Many of them. He was absolutely treated in violation of all international law, and nobody said a word. It went down. The John Walker Lynn story is, for me, very instructive. And I'm not suggesting there's a commonality of guilt, but there is a sense that if the public had responded differently, if the Republic hadn't joined in fear, anger, wanting payback, we might have had, even the Bush-Cheney crowd might have been a little more reticent about doing the stuff they did. I do believe that.
Thank you. I think that's right, but let me go back to the point of the Vice President, his role in this. I think that willing administration is worried about appropriations. But I think they're worried about appropriations because usually that's followed up with oversight. And by getting the money somewhere else and trying to avoid the provisions of the Constitution that said no money can be spent except through appropriations, they somehow think they're going to escape responsibility. But I don't think they usually, with time, it leaks out and they're accountable. And I think the thing that a willing administration most fears is public understanding of what's going on, the facts. Jay Rockefeller, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, a few years ago said, there's a distinction between oversight and undersight. He said, oversight is when you know enough to ask the questions. Undersight is when you do not know enough to even ask the questions. And I think when the Congress is in that position, the press is in that position, we just don't know how to get our handle on something because we don't know enough. That's when the country's in trouble. That's when the system doesn't work. And that's why the press has to function. That's why the Congress has to function. And why we have to look at the unique role of the Vice Presidency under Cheney. Because a Vice President is in a unique constitutional position. They're both in the executive and the legislative branch. No one else is. Cheney was always playing this game. If you tried to get him to respond because he was in the Congress, he said, no, I'm in the White House. And if you tried to get him to answer, in the executive branch, he said, no, I'm president of the Senate. And you never got an answer out of him for 8 years. And so they ran a government within a government, out of the White House, accountable to no one. And I think that's an example, a precedent, that should be worrisome.
Now, Mr. Mondale, I just want to ask, you raised the particular role of Vice President Cheney. Many historians and students of the Vice Presidency and the Presidency single out your term as Vice President as the game changer. Before that, the vice president waited around for the president to die, basically. And that happened, they stepped in. And when you came in, it was a very special understanding with President Carter. You got all the information. Your staffs were integrated. You were going to the meetings. Is there some concern on your part that Dick Cheney is a culmination of what you've been experiencing?
Because we executivized the vice president. We brought him out from the cold and put him in the White House, and I think it really worked. But it went off the rails under Cheney. And I think it's something we really have to study carefully, which is why I hope the Congress will look into this and provide a report, because those precedents are dangerous. You say, well, that just happened once. My experience in government is if it's happened once, it's a precedent. It's like a loaded pistol that you leave on the dining room table. It's dangerous, and you have to deal with a dangerous precedent.
You know, I read a bunch of papers today. You gave me a bunch of documents that you discovered in the Carter Library about his term as vice president. And I read a lot of them this afternoon, your meetings in South Africa and in Europe. And they weren't in South Africa, mostly in Europe.
Yeah.
The South Africans, and also in China. And the thing that was interesting in reading, and you were very active, but there was complete sort of transparency. Everything, there was this incredible volume of paper that your office produced and that was sent to everybody else. It was sent to the State Department, it was sent to the President, it was sent to other offices. There was none of, I know you were just making a rhetorical point in saying that there was no notion of any consolidation of power above and beyond that was granted. And it was different use. It was a much more energetic use of you, which was interesting. And that's the model. I mean, in a way, you can argue that would be the role model for how to use a vice president instead of, it's not so much Bush Cheney. Most of the time, I don't think George Bush was much of a vice president to Ronald Reagan in that sense, his father. They were all caught up in Iran-Contra. I don't think you can make a case for any precedent, for anything that Bush Cheney really did. I just don't think you can. I think they were so completely different. As somebody said in one of the early stories I wrote about in the New Yorker, I quoted somebody very wise in the government. And we should say that. I'm sure that's implicit in everything we're saying here. I can tell you that when they're good, they're really good. In the military, in the CIA, in the FBI, you have an overwhelming 99% of the people just want to do exactly what everybody in this audience wants to do. They want to do their job right. And so what you have is this incredible... I've lost my track of what I was going to say.
It's good, though.
I knew it once, I'll know it again. I still know it now.
Mr. Mondo, let me come back to you. You wrote what I think is a very important book, Accountability and Power. And in it, you said, our task is, quote, to acknowledge the importance of presidential power, but to insist on the greater importance of accountable presidential power. And we've been talking about, this arc from the Vietnam War started in a big way by Lyndon Johnson's escalation of troops from 10,000 to over 500,000. Through the Nixon and then Reagan and Bush years. I'm wondering, have you rethought a bit about this argument about the accountability of power? Should we rethink the idea of presidential power? Do we want a weak president? Should that be the conclusion we take out of the Bush-Cheney years? Is this a new time point?
We need a strong president. The system requires a strong president. The world we're in, we can't do without a strong president. But I think the history of these scandals have all had the same result. It's produced a weak president. The fact is, these abuses destroyed the Bush-Cheney administration. They destroyed Lyndon Johnson. When they go down that road, it weakens the presidency. It doesn't strengthen it. I got an old speech I gave today, and it was a letter to the president in 19-something, I'm giving him advice on how to be a president. This, I think, was the Bush. And I said, Mr. President, you must never abandon your office, your oath to faithfully execute the law of the land. Your job will be horribly frustrating. Congress, the press, the courts, the cabinet, our allies, the embassies, practically everything will frustrate you. At some point, you'll be tempted to break out of the constraints by resorting to private government outside the law. You will be told that you can achieve by covert and extra-legal means what you cannot do openly and legally. The problem is, it just doesn't work that way. And you'll be told that no one will ever find out about it. This thought occurs to every president, and my advice to you, President, don't do it. You can't keep it a secret if it's significant. It has never worked in the past, and I don't believe it ever will. If what you're doing will offend public opinion, its disclosure will be doubly offensive because you've not only covered up, but what you're doing is outrageous and people will never forgive you for it. I think there's a strong, repeated lesson in modern history that this stuff ruins the president.
When did you write that?
87.
Really?
But it's yours. You can go with it.
No.
I think this is a very important theme, basically talking about the paradox of presidential prerogative. That in the one instance, presidents have quite a bit of leeway, maybe rope. But the next instance, you do get the pushback from the media, takes some time, or the courts, or the legislative branch wakes up. Now, when you think about this notion of countable power, though, and you think about the last 8 years, and let's say, you know, the last part of the Bush presidency, what do you think of the job that the democratically controlled Congress did in terms of checking the president?
I think they were slow to get to it. They took the Congress back in 06. The committees did get stronger. The record of the Congress before that, we would call it the broken branch. They were compliant. The investigating committees never investigated. They rarely met. They didn't pass many laws because the executive took care of it for them. And one of the reasons the Democrats got elected in 06 is the public census. And they wanted checks and balances. They wanted a Congress that would produce oversight. But I would say it got off to a slow start, and maybe because we were damaged. But some leaders developed, and I won't, like Henry Waxman, Pat Leahy, and there's several others that really knew what the Congress should do and began to organize the Congress and make it much more effective. I think they've done better this time, but they've got a lot of work to do, and they'll be tested on this issue.
Thank you. I want to go into a different topic, and it's kind of the tension between the First Amendment rights to free speech, free press, and generally public disclosure, and national security issues. Both of you, in different ways, have kind of gone to that time. When you were, in fact, running the church committee on the domestic side, there were a lot of critics who warned that public disclosure would undermine American national security, and a lot of your reporting, seems to me I've read some quotes from senior administration officials referring to you alone as a national security threat. and I'm wondering how you think about this tension. Is public disclosure, even of government secrets, a threat to our security as a country?
I think there are secrets that must be kept. I think that there's a zone of privacy around the president in normal matters. But I think as the Nixon wiretap case, or the Nixon-Lust case demonstrated, there's limits to what a president can protect himself from in terms of the public process. And I think when it comes to fundamentals, the Congress under the Constitution has the ability and the responsibility of oversight, of checking and balancing and holding the president accountable, just as the courts do, and if the American people know, as they must do also. So I think that's the system that was intended in the Federalist Papers, wonderful document, Federalist Paper 51. Madison wrote that the idea of this Constitution is to pit ambition against ambition. If men were angels, we wouldn't need this sort of thing. But because we're flawed, because human beings will make mistakes if they're in positions of unaccountable power, we must have auxiliary precautions. In other words, this is a system that trusted human nature and was distrustful at the same time. It's a paradox. But I think it's that tension that's allowed America to grow and solve its problems.
And when you were sitting on the Church Committee and you're looking at all these top secret documents, you're going through the FBI files, the CIA files, you're finding these outrageous efforts to undermine Dr. King and Hubert Humphrey and others. Did it strike you that the disclosure in a public way would threaten the country's stability and security?
We worked very hard on that. There were things we never disclosed and never wanted. For example, agents' names. Well, we never wanted to get in means or methods. There are many, many things that the committee agreed, we didn't want to hear about it, we didn't want the names, we didn't want any testimony. We got criticized once, falsely, for having exposed an agent in Athens, but we had not done that. But my answer to that was to know everything we said publicly was solid. And the facts surrounding what we said spoke for themselves. Because in that way, we stripped the argument that we were trying to run down American security and instead showed Americans how by living by a better law and a different process, we could be stronger and save ourselves from these kinds of embarrassing. So, and I think we carried the public on that because we were able to get inside and get the facts and so on. So that's the way I handle it. I think a Congress that's compliant, doesn't ask a question, weakens the country. And that's an essential part of their job.
Mr. Hirsch, you are front lines of receiving a lot of information from all different sources. How do you think about this kind of, what's your role in balancing public disclosure and your genuine concern about the country's security?
The issue of, when I worked, this came up more acutely at the New York Times because then the Vietnam War was going and we had 58,000 men and women killed in that war. Every day the death toll was high. You don't publish everything you know. That'd be no responsible person. Every secret, there are secrets worth keeping. Mr. Mondale's talked about embarrassing facts, or facts that if they became known would embarrass the government. That's the kind of issue you get. And I can tell you at the New York Times, there were many times we received information and we decided, it's a funny world we live in. Because basically, the First Amendment is very clear, the Jeffersonian First Amendment, which is basically it's their job to keep it secret and our job to find out. And there's nothing in America, there's no bar in the United States to publishing any information, unlike any other country. We were talking earlier about even in England, there are bars. So we really have an incredible system in the United States that's, there's nothing like it, I think. It's the most democratic form, and the First Amendment is so pure. So we would, at the New York Times, often my editor when I worked there for critical years was A.M. Rosenthal, and he would sometimes say, it's what I feel about this in the stomach. But in general, what happened is, in general, the kind of information you get about operations come from people inside who have tried to change or stop something. They think it's crazy. I mean, literally, they think it's dangerous. And these are the people who, in desperation, I'm talking about well-meaning people, will go to a reporter and say, here's what I know, in the assumption that I'm also going to do the work on it to get it more rounded and get more information and insulate him, the person giving me the information. And in general, what happened is, I can say at the New York Times in particular, less than in the Bush-Cheney years, the president or the national security advisor or Henry Kissinger would call up sometimes my editor, A. Rosenthal, sometimes the publisher, Arthur Punch Sulzberger, and they would say, if you publish this story tomorrow morning, it would be a grave national security issue. And in every case, except once, we decided to publish. And, the son of a gun, The commies weren't parachuting into San Francisco the next morning. And so in each case, they were exaggerating the danger. What we would do, and what I did in some cases involving CIA people along the line you made, we would say, we're not going to publish this for 5 days. Get your people out of there. They don't belong there. They have no business doing what they're doing. Get them out. It's your call. And you know, the classic case that was said during the legal debate about the Pentagon Papers, in which the court, as you know, the Supreme Court upheld the New York Times publication of the most top secret document you'll ever want to see in the Pentagon Papers. In the argument at one point, Alexander Bickel was the New York Times lawyer, the famous Yale professor of law. And at one point during the colloquy, one of the justices asked him, suppose you had, you know, he was talking about the right to publish anything. And somebody said, suppose it's 1915 or 1916, and we've got a troop ship full of doughboys going out to France. And we know, you know, that the German U-boats are outside the harbor, as they were in those days, at the end of later, 1917, World War II. Should that be a time you don't publish? Is that a time when this prior restraint is appropriate? And Alexander Bickel said, yes, that would be a case in which we should not publish. And what I would say, as a non-lawyer, I would say, no, no. The argument is, if we know it, they must know it. Publish it and make them change the day and keep the secret better. That's another argument I would have made in court. I'm serious. I would have said, publish and say to them, hold that ship, find another day, and do it better. Because that's another, I think, rational response to that kind of a question. So prior restraint, it's complicated. You know, one more thing I was going to say to you about presidents in this thing, that I had a CIA director once say to me, you can't understand what it's like for the president. He gets in the office, and he thinks, my God, I'm the most powerful guy in the world. And he's got the Congress, and he's got his staff, and he's got the National Security Advisor fighting, and he's got everybody fighting, and he can't get anything done. He's got his wife yelling at him about something she wants. And all he can do is take a walk in the Rose Garden with the CIA director.
Yeah.
It's done.
Yeah.
It's the most attractive thing in the world. I can take a walk in the Rose Garden, just the two of us, and I can get something done.
He thinks.
Yeah. That's a good point. He thinks.
And somehow you find out about a lot of those walks in the Rose Garden. And I'm wondering, you know, about some of the more recent stories you've run, and whether you've thought about this balance between public disclosure and national security. One of the stories you broke was about American covert operations in Iraq. And I think most people would recognize that the potential of Iran developing a nuclear weapon is something that would be of little concern. You know, it's a real threat both to our allies and to our own interests as a country. Was there a moment when you thought disclosing these efforts would either put the covert forces in danger or would hurt the country's interests?
What the story was, you're talking about a story last summer in which the Democratic leadership of the Congress said okay to a secret appropriation of up to $400 million. I don't know how much actually was spent. I know that was the amount that he authorized for operations inside Iran by the same unit, Joint Special Operations Command. And the reason they had to go to Congress is the CIA was involved too, and the CIA refused to do an operation without money from Congress. They wouldn't go with they wouldn't go with outside money. They learned their lessons. And so they had to go get a finding. And they had to go under the law. The CIA had to get permission. And what they did is they went before the House and Senate Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. It's a very small group in the House. It's John Murtha and Obie, the Democrats, on it. Just four members. And they went before them and they said, I'm not saying anything that I didn't write, maybe a little more directly here. They said, we want permission to have defensive lethal authority. Defensive lethal authority inside Iran. What do you mean? Well, in case our guys get caught, we want to be able to shoot our way out. Well, I have to tell you, the Congress, the legislators, were far from convinced that was the truth. Because, of course, you have the right to shoot your way out. So what were they doing? I think I can tell you now that one of the initial goals was, and you can decide for yourself whether this is in the kind of practice that you want the Americans to do. They were going to try and snatch an Iranian nuclear scientist inside Tehran and get them to come to America and tell the truth about how far along they were in the bomb, on the assumption that they were much farther. The audience here should know that the official estimates of the United States intelligence community
in total collaboration with all 16 major elements, in, published in December of 2007, was that the Iranians stopped any effort to actually weaponize in 5 years ago, in 03, 04, and that they're not close to a bomb. I think Admiral Blair, the new head of intelligence, has said as much in the last few days again. They're not, there's time. It doesn't mean they don't want a bomb. And frankly, if I were the Iranians listening to what Bush and Cheney have said about me, I'd want 500 bombs, but that's another story. We never kind of think of the consequences of our action. But the goal was to snatch scientists and get them to come and give false testimony to the American people. And the problem was, and what I'm telling you now, I don't know. What I'm saying is information I don't know empirically, like I know the earlier sentence. What I'm telling you now is I know heuristically from how they operate. If they happen to snatch somebody who did not want to do it, he wasn't long for life. I can just tell you that. The goal was to present false testimony. And I would argue that case, that notion, that kind of operation, I did not write all of that in there because I had constraints. There were people then, it's now, it's then, and this, there's a new government. And I have actually gone inside and made sure that, told people in the Obama, I'm just praying that they're getting all the briefings they need on it. They are getting briefings on it. I can tell you right now, there were people inside the Obama administration that were appalled by what was going on inside Iran. And I hope, I think they stopped it, I don't know. I just know that they, when they finally got an account of what's going on, they did not like what they hear, so I've been told.
Can I just say one thing about this line of questions about the tension between openness and security? I think when our nation was founded, and the Constitution was developed, and the Bill of Rights was adopted, that as a nation, we made a decision. Yes, there would be problems with openness, but we were better off in the long run as a nation if we took the risk of the cost of openness rather than the risk of authoritarian government and closure of the public debate. And I think the verdict of American history is that was exactly the right choice to make, and it's been a good one for us.
That wonderful transition. Dean Nichols.
Larry, thank you. Thank you for this just immensely rich and important conversation we've had. I'm privileged to hear. It's